Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte clear liners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces, plus they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you could pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
The Institute of Art and Ideas, articles, videos, and podcasts.
Hello and welcome to Philosophy for Our Times, the podcast that brings you the world's leading thinkers on today's biggest ideas. We value the feeling of happiness above all else. But is it time we outgrew this self-centered ideology? On today's episode, we're discussing happiness and the future of our society. Joining us to share his vision for a post-liberal society is renowned theologian and president of the Centre of Theology and Religion at the University of Nottingham, John Milbank.
But a certain group of people have very deliberately set out to dominate the narrative. And these are the people who are known as neoliberals.
If you enjoyed today's episode, don't forget to like and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Leave us a review, join the conversation on Facebook and Twitter, and head over to our website, iai.tv. Back now to John Milbank.
I'm here to talk to you about post-liberalism. The first thing I think that it's important to say about post-liberalism is the stress on the word post. It doesn't exactly mean anti-liberalism. And I think now we are faced with a big anti-liberal reaction. It's much more trying to say that liberalism as such is not enough. Well, what do I mean by liberalism? For the purposes of this talk and my political philosophy, I'm defining liberalism as a political position that wants to start with the isolated individual, the isolated, atomic, abstracted individual, not considered in their relationality or their historical situation, and so on, but treats the individual as basic. And from that follows, I think, two alternative values which can get combined. First of all, the idea that you're promoting, as far as possible, the liberty, the freedom of choice of the individual, or else, to refer to the talk's title, the idea that you're trying to promote the happiness of the individual. But happiness of the individual in a rather kind of basic, sort of sensuous, materialist, utilitarian sense. So on the one hand, we've got what philosophers call negative liberty, freedom of choice. On the other hand, we've got happiness. And both of those things, of course, are very important, but are they enough? Are they sufficient? And I would want to suggest that, in fact, this hasn't always been the dominant position, even in modern politics. Liberalism hasn't had it all its own way. And that besides the importance of emancipation, that means freeing people from oppression of their just liberties, freeing people from unnecessary suffering, there's also been a pursuit of much more positive ends of community, group identity, national identity, educational goals, even religious goals. And these have always been part of the modern story. And these have tended to go along with promoting relationality and with promoting the strength of groups. And often the story of the rise of the working classes, the increase in the strength of working classes, has been as much to do with these positive goals as with the negative ones. It's been about community and solidarity, advancing certain very, very strongly held working class values. So liberalism was never simply the whole story. But I think that ever since, the roughly speaking, the 1970s, we've started to think that it is the whole story, that we can identify modernity wholesale with liberalism. And exactly why is that? Well, I think part of the answer is that there's nothing accidental about this whatsoever. But a certain group of people have very deliberately set out to dominate the narrative. And these are the people who are known as neoliberals. There's an American version of neoliberalism, but perhaps the most basic and dominant version was an Austrian and German version. Now, what does neoliberalism really mean? Well, what distinguishes it mainly from traditional liberalism is the idea that it's not enough to just kind of remove the power of the state and then automatically you'll get free market values. It's much more the idea that we need to set up a deliberate set of laws that put the market first and put individual liberty absolutely first. So that from the start, the thing that really distinguished neoliberalism was the search for a new global order that especially the Geneva group of neoliberals associated with Friedrich Hayek set out deliberately to bypass democracy, to create a new sort of purely economic global empire, if you like. And I say global, I say purely economic, but actually they envisaged there being all sorts of international legal institutions that would override nations and national democracy. And they were also very keen on the idea that laws would be mainly made by judges rather than by sovereign parliaments. I'm exaggerating a little, but really very little. There was a kind of overriding of national democracy intended from the outset. And the fear here was primarily a fear of socialism and of people who want to redistribute economic resources. That was seen as interfering with the purity of the market. So if we now live in an era where we talk a lot about globalization, to some degree, that's not an accident. That's not just something historically inevitable. This idea that we need to put the economic first and have international laws that put the economic first is something that people have deliberately pursued. And over the course of time, if not originally, that aim for an international economic empire got fused with a discourse about human rights. And again, the idea that individual rights must be put above individual duties or relational solidarity, that has come more and more to dominate. And the idea then that maybe the courts, especially courts in charge of human rights, can override collective decisions. And I think that already in that marriage between economic liberty and human rights, you've got one example of the next thing that I want to talk about, the peculiarity of the liberal domination of the times in which we live. An awful lot of people by now have noted that ever since the 1970s, we've had the very strange phenomenon that the political left has won the cultural war. if we think about personal relations and sexuality and so on. The left has won the cultural war, but the right has won the economic war. Overwhelmingly, we've drifted to pro-capitalist policies ever since that epoch. Now, again, as an awful lot of people have by now said, this makes much more sense if you stop thinking in terms of left and right. And if you say, well, basically, it's the rich that have won. And rich people have always been people, or often anyway, have been people, if they're not constrained, who want wealth in order to do just what they like. In other words, left-wing cultural liberalism and right-wing economic liberalism are really two halves of the same picture. And they've tended to converge. And actually, if you look at the evidence, from quite early on, new left cultural liberals started to drift in a more and more pro-free market direction. So we've got this combination of cultural liberalism and so-called economic conservatism, although economic liberalism would be more the right way to understand that. Now, the extraordinary thing is that although that combination dominates of left culture, right-wing economics, there's an awful lot of evidence that it's the exact opposite of what most people want. Most people are culturally really inclined to be quite conservative. They're not intolerant, but they put a very strong value on family, place, inherited tradition, national tradition, sometimes on religious community. On the other hand, they do have an increasing sense that the current economic setup is very, very unfair. There's increasing inequality, absolutely massive salary differentials, an increasing power of the super rich or unaccountable who go in for tax evasion and so on. And the sense that people are powerless in the face of this sort of thing. So we've got this absolute hegemony of liberalism, that which our sort of shadow play, shadow boxing between the left and the right, tends to disguise from us. And I think this is one reason why recently we've had such a populist reaction against normal left-right politics. But there's another factor here that needs to be brought into consideration. And that's the fact that there seems to be a new class divide around education. If you go back 40 years or so ago, people, highly educated people, were as divided in their political positions as anybody else. And if anything, they leant towards conservatism. But today that's been completely reversed. Overwhelmingly, people with more advanced education tend towards the liberal left. Although, once again, if you look into the details, one tends to find that fusion of cultural liberalism with economic liberalism. So we've got this new kind of class divide, what a lot of people have called the rule of the meritocracy, the rule of people who think they have the right to rule because they've got very, very high levels of educational attainment. And the problem is that sometimes that group of people have not, like an older aristocracy, inherited any very strong sense of social responsibility. And they tend to live in the big cities. Even if they're not super wealthy themselves, they tend to be serving the super wealthy. They tend to be linked to the new economy, the finance economy, or the information economy. And all the evidence is that there's an increasingly divide between these so-called what David Goodhart calls anywheres and a bigger number of people who are somewheres, who are much more embedded in their localities, in what people sometimes call the heartlands, and sometimes doing more traditional jobs or else in very low-paid service jobs. And they tend to get their happiness from a sense of belonging, whereas the anywhere more metropolitan people get their sense of happiness and self-worth simply from their sense of global achievements. And this is, as it were, transferable anywhere. They can travel anywhere and take their self-worth and high valuation with them. And this is not so possible for most people. But what is sometimes called the revolt of the elites, somehow it seems that increasingly people who are extremely wealthy or relatively highly wealthy are disjoined from the mass of the people, no longer have the same sense of responsibility from them, and are often baffled by the attitude of most people, and even see most people, in Hillary Clinton's words, as somehow deplorable. And this shows up, for example, in attitudes towards immigration, where it's assumed that a lot of ordinary people are simply bigots, when in fact, because of labor arbitrage and so on, immigration is used to exploit people's labor, both the labor of immigrants themselves and the labor of native workers. Whereas the anywhere people, the people living in the hubs rather than the heartlands, are often enjoying the benefit of relatively cheap immigrant labor. People from desperately poor countries, much more prepared to put up with anything compared to native labor. So that the sort of liberalism that you seem to get about multiculturalism and so on can have a more dubious kind of economic rationale going on behind it. So I think for this set of reasons, because of the almost deliberate pursuit of globalization, because of the hidden hegemony of liberalism across both left and right, because of the new dividing line, the new class dividing line, which is education, such that people who feel they're excluded from the knowledge of economy have become the new lower class, if you like. I think for all these three reasons, where we've been seeing a huge populist reaction, which has shown itself in Eastern Europe, it's shown itself in Italy, it's shown itself in the election of Donald Trump, and of course in this country, it's shown itself with Brexit. Now, would I identify populism with post-liberalism, and can populism be a successful mode of resistance to liberalism? Well, I would suggest not, and for a whole series of reasons. I think, first of all, populism compared to old working class-based politics tends to be much more disaggregated. The very kind of exclusions that people are suffering is individuating them. And populism doesn't really overcome that individualization, that people fail to act coherently as groups, and the goals they're pursuing are perhaps too inchoate. We've seen this in the case of France, for example, the Gilets Jaunes. And secondly, I think that the link of populism to nationalism, and here I probably dissent from quite a number of other people whom I respect and would also call themselves post-liberal. Although it is important to reassert national identity and national pride and national levels of decision-making, there's a sense in which this can only go so far in resisting an economy totally dominated by neoliberalism. So that what you tend to find with national populism is that it's often a hybrid between nationalist values and remaining elements of neoliberalism. In particular, what economists call fiscal dumping tends to go on. In other words, the only way to sustain your national independence is to have a rather deregulated economy that will appeal to international investors. And if, on the other hand, you want to have high levels of welfare and so on, then often you're having to go into debt to fund that, and that locks you still more into the global economy. And I also think for other reasons that national populism has not clearly broken with liberalism. There's a sense in which the nation state is only the individual writ large. In fact, the rise of the individual and the rise of the modern sovereign nation state have always gone hand in hand, just for that reason. You know, what value are you celebrating if you celebrate your own nation? Okay, sort of wonderful things that you can't put into words about spiritual traditions and legacies and so on, but it can dangerously become just a sort of arbitrary identity thing. And this is where I think the religious dimension does come in, that, you know, once upon a time, to be British meant also perhaps to be Protestant, at least also to be Christian, but it was a local version of something nonetheless universal. And I think one reason why in the modern world nationalism is so dangerous is that it is post-secular. It turns racist very quickly because of the rejection of any link between the local and the universal that religion gives, so that you tend to get a religion of the nation as a substitute. And very, very worryingly, if you look at Poland, for example, we're now seeing kind of modes of Catholic fascism, for example, and linkages between nationalism on the one hand and a debased form of religiosity celebrating the nation. We see the same thing in Russia and so on. So that I have to say that I'm much warier of this rise of nationalism than some post-liberals would be. So if I'm denying that populism and national populism can be identified as authentically post-liberal, what do I take authentic post-liberalism to mean? Well, very briefly, primarily, it's a politics that puts human relationality central, not individualism and not collectivism either, not individualism writ large, but precisely our relationality. It's only through our relationship to the past, to other people now, that we can develop as individuals. This is often referred to with the word personalism. I believe in personalism rather than individualism. And personalism stresses the situation, the situatedness of every individual and the importance of relationality for their development. The second key thing I would stress is the notion of flourishing, that we're not just pursuing individual liberty, we're not just pursuing a very basic kind of happiness, but we're also trying to work out what the good life is for everybody, and we're encouraging people to pursue it. We believe that some goals are more fulfilling than others. At the moment, we're discovering, a lot of us, I think, that actually staying in your locality and noticing nature and walking about is a lot more fulfilling than being a permanent globe-trotting consumer. So maybe you need to build our lives more around that. That means there's a collective acceptance of positive ends for human life. Okay, there's ongoing open debate about what the good life should be. But nonetheless, post-liberal politics, like the ancients, like the medievals, sees politics as fundamentally educative. It's a politics based around the citizen. That means participatory self-government, but it also means a continued mutual education by the citizens where they're trying to educate themselves into the good life. It's not a kind of, well, what you like is what you like kind of attitude that tends to prevail in our hyper-liberal world. The other thing that I think is important, or one other thing, is to try to somehow reshape our elites, to try to remove a culture where you get prestige just because you have a lot of money or a lot of celebrity or a lot of power. We've somehow got to tie power and leadership back to responsibility. And this is not empty idealism. We need the idea of disgrace, that it's disgraceful to not to achieve your use your eminent position well, that you will only be honored for receiving it well. And this is a kind of subtle cultural alteration that I think we need to undergo. And then there are two other things I'd like to mention also. I'm very pleased that Annalise Dodds, the shadow vice chancellor, has started to talk about a new corporatism, a new breaking down of the artificial liberal divide between the political and the economic. She's been talking about the need to for governments only to support businesses that are going in a socially beneficial direction, that are involving their workers, developing industrial democracy, pursuing good ecological practices, and not just pursuing profits, but trying to manufacture or offer a service that fulfills a definite social function, that delivers a definite social good. And I think if you do that, as we've already seen in relation to COVID-19, with the government once again talking to businesses and the unions, if businesses do that, then it becomes more legitimate for them to be in turn involved in the political process. We don't just live in places. The representation only of places is not democratically logical. It makes sense also to democratically represent vocations and what we do at work, if those things are also themselves to a degree democratically organized. And then the final thing that I want to say reverts to my worry about excessive nationalism. I think, yes, part of the reaction against liberal globalization is to return to putting decision-making at local, regional, and at national levels. But I don't think that reverting to a situation of liberal international anarchy, where the nation is the final sort of democratic political stopping point, I don't think that's going to work, because the whole project, liberal, neoliberal project we're up against, is this attempt to have international rule through the economy. And even though it's true that you've got a phenomenon like Trump, but it's only semi-protectionist. In fact, in the end, he's still using the United States as a base for a still more anarchic, still more piratical mode of economic practice. He's trying to escape from the international legal economic framework, but only in favor of, if you like, still more anarchy, so that without some kind of international political dimension, we're still dominated by the global economy, or else we're dominated by very big nations like China or the United States that are fusing capitalism with technocracy and bureaucracy and so on, to create an even more terrible kind of managerialism. So the final thing I would like to say is post-liberalism going to happen? I don't know, probably not. We'll probably stagger on with what Ross Duhar calls a decadent mode of liberalism. Not very impressive, but it staggers on. Or else we'll see a terrible new hybrid between capitalism and bureaucracy and technocracy of the kind that China represents. But I think if we're not going to have those pretty dreadful things, then trying to craft a post-liberal alternative is the way forward.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of Philosophy for Our Times. Remember to like, subscribe, and review wherever you listen. And tune in next week for more big ideas from the world's leading thinkers.